taking care of business. Path to Pro Radio is on.
Yeah. All right. Grammy award-winning intro that watches the Grammy Rock and Roll Hall of
sweet,
Fame.
Sweet licks right there. Yeah, they'll let anybody into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, man. You might be next.
I could be next. I
mean, come to think about it. Welcome to Path to Pro. I'm Jimmy Ray.
And I'm Bill Crespo here today. And we're excited about today because actually I've known this person for a long time. And he's very instrumental in what's happening around the country in real estate. Chris Heller is here. And he is CEO of Ojo, and he's been a top producing agent. But anyway, Chris, thanks for being on. I know the weather's crazy in Austin.
It's crazy and it changes by the minute, but I'm excited to be here with you guys.
Well, okay. Welcome to Path to Pro. You know, this is all about helping people to understand through interviews with people that have done really well in their industries, about letting people know what kind of mindset, you know, what kind of people when people make moves, how do they make the moves to get them to this level of excellence, much like you have achieved in their career? What's the mindset? Was their childhood influential on them in that way? So we're just kind of interested in, you know, how does somebody get that mojo that Chris has?
Did your parents beat you to this level, Chris, to get here? How did you, you know, I never asked you this because you started at 20 years old in real estate. Is real interesting. How did you, what made you get in?
I was a sophomore in college. My dad called me one day and said, "Hey, you're going to get your real estate license and come up to Lake Tahoe," where he was at, "and work for the summer."
Oh.
He was managing a timeshare resort. And I said, okay. I was very, very, very shy and introverted, like, you know, at the farthest end of that spectrum that you could imagine.
Wow.
And I got up there and he said, "All right, go on this tour with this couple and this salesperson, a 90-minute tour, and just watch and listen." I came back and he goes, "Now it's your turn."
Oh,
and so I just got thrown into the deep end. Make a long story short, I got very good at it. Did that while going to school part-time for 3 years. Met a real estate broker along the way in San Diego, where we later moved to take on a different resort. And for 3 years, that broker recruited me, called me, wrote me letters every time I saw him, tried to get me to come and join him. And finally, he caught me at a weak moment. I said, "All right, I'll give this real estate thing a try." And I'm glad he was persistent.
So your dad was very successful in real estate in his own right then.
He was successful in that niche of it. He was managing large sales forces of people, salespeople selling timeshare resorts, quite different than residential real estate, but it prepared me very well because after 3 years of doing that, literally most of the time, 7 days a week, I had no fear of rejection anymore because I got rejected at the highest level for a long, long time.
That's one thing I know about Chris, man. He is a prospect. Well, his team was incredible in San Diego. But that was one thing that I just, how did you get over this whole rejection thing? What did you do, or what was the mindset? And we'll talk a little bit more about your book, but how did you get that mindset to get through this rejection that you got?
I never viewed it as a negative thing, and probably because I just didn't care about it that much. You know, when you're very outgoing and extroverted, I think you care more about what people think and
that's true.
What it might mean to you. But for me, it didn't faze me. I was so focused and so driven on the outcome and my goals that rejection was just like a competition. It was just, you know, what part of what happened. It was just, you know, each rejection was one step closer to it. To a yes, you know, as we've heard before.
Yeah. But you know, you just made a good point. You know, so we're so concerned about what people think. You didn't really care what they thought about you. You were on your mission, which is so interesting. And then
there's actually a chapter in the book that says, "Don't worry about what others think," because when we do that, when we're worrying about what others think, it changes our actions, it changes our thoughts, it changes our approach. It causes us, in real estate and in sales, you see this a lot where people don't do the necessary follow-up or effective follow-up because they're so worried about what the, you know, the person on the other end of the receiving end of that follow-up will be thinking, or you know, am I bothering them, or am I, you know, am I too salesy, or you know, are they going to get mad, or you know, they salespeople become their own worst enemies by those thoughts they have,
their own limitations they put on themselves.
Yeah, I call it the you know, not listening to the second thought. You know, the first thought oh, I should follow up with this person, or oh, I wonder, you know, this prospect enters your mind. And I always tell people, as soon as that enters your mind, act on it. But what people do is they have a second thought. The second thought is, oh, it's too soon, it's too early, it's too late, it's too often. It's, you know, the second thought is what sabotages them.
And then you keep thinking more and more about this thing.
In fact, your book is called Dominate Thoughts.
Yeah, it's Dominant Thoughts. It's all about mindset. It's just really taking the lessons that I've learned over the last 30 or 40 years from some of the greatest mentors that anyone would have an opportunity to work with, and wove it into a short story, a business parable about a mentor and a mentee.
Now, you know, I started with the same coaching company that you were with for a long time in 2005. So I knew about Chris's success in what he was doing with prospecting. And just tell him a little bit how you developed that team and how focused you guys were at prospecting for new business.
Well, my first year in the business, I didn't, you know, this was so long ago that this was before the internet. So there was no, you know, I couldn't watch any YouTube videos or research anything. Training was almost non-existent. So I just had to figure it out. And, you know, that first year, literally working 7 days a week and 12, 13, 14 hours a day, I sold 27 homes and was rookie of the year in San Diego. But at the end of that year, I realized it would have been physically impossible to work any more or any harder than I just did. And yet, how was I going to sell more homes and achieve my goals if I couldn't work harder? So I had to, you know, figure out, okay, there's got to be other parts of this. So what I immediately did is I hired an assistant. And back then, that was very, very uncommon. This was 1989. And, you know, real estate agents didn't have assistants. You know, when I hired one, and I was one of the younger agents in an office, and people were looking at me like,
yeah, you're nuts.
Yeah, who do you think you are? Like the president? You have an assistant? And,
yeah.
And I'm like, well, I've been watching you stuff envelopes for the last 5 hours, and I'm going to pay someone to do that.
Yeah, that's good.
But you know, the thing
licking for stamps.
Young real estate agents listening to this, they can't even have any conception of what it was like before the internet to do what you did.
Oh, yeah. Can you think about that?
I mean, the work that you had to do that now it seems like, wow, it's just
and
so
they're
much
still
easier.
Complaining about it.
Well, like, and I still, to this day, I still have my team in San Diego. I've had that team has been operating for 34 years now and still is a high functioning team, helping a lot of people buy and sell homes. And it has changed a lot, but the fundamentals haven't changed. And the whole concept around mindset, discipline, you know, not sabotaging yourself, you know, being willing to do what it takes, even on the days you don't want to do it.
Yeah.
That part is every bit as relevant today as it was 10 years ago or 30 years ago.
What was the hardest, you know, as you developed your team, what was the most difficult part about going to that next level to building an assistant and all the steps you went to get to high level of production? What was the biggest challenge in that?
You know, there were different challenges at different levels. Early on, the biggest challenge was me, and that I wasn't a good leader or manager, and not only was I not one, I had the attitude I didn't need to be one, that everyone should just be like me, everyone should be, you know, completely driven and focused, right, and that. So, you know, after having a lot of good people come and go and realize that I was the common denominator of why they would come and go, you know, then I started to really have a change of view on that, started to really develop myself as a leader and as as someone who could develop people and have people, you know, be excited to be there and do the things we need to do to win. So that was definitely one challenge. And then I think, again, I wasn't born more disciplined or with a stronger mindset than anyone else. I may have had more drive and desire than some people, but drive and desire alone doesn't cure all.
Right.
So then really developing a lot of discipline in certain areas and quite frankly, in the most important areas that would allow me to achieve the things I wanted to achieve.
And I think, do you agree that to be able to self-reflect on your abilities and inabilities and maybe turnoffs to people or whatever, you were talking about people leaving, I think that's a key component to being a great leader, don't you?
Without a doubt. There's no one that we would consider a great leader that doesn't have that characteristic and that ability.
You know, and you started, not that we got to do a commercial on coaching, but I got to see, I used to see you on stage and talk, you know, I'm there as a coach looking at how these successful agents, and to have a team that's still in existence for 30 some years is first of all, unheard of. I mean, usually people just die out of the business. They just decide to go into doing something else. How much of going into coaching really took you to another level for you?
I think it was probably one of the most important decisions and probably the most beneficial decision I ever made. I remember it was in 1996, and it was the day that I heard that I could hire a coach who would hold me accountable, help me achieve my goals, caused me to see the things I wasn't seeing, all the things that a coach does. I was like, sign me up. I want that. And to this day, in fact, tomorrow I have my call with my coach. To this day, I have a coach, and I've had one through, my whole career.
Well, I mean, even Tiger Woods has a coach.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's smart. That's something that great leaders understand. You know, I need somebody else to keep me on the straight and narrow here.
I remember watching you. Before I got into coaching, I don't know if I was running a company managing at the time, I forgot what it was, and I watched these guys go on the bus. Remember the bus you guys used to go on? And all of a sudden, Chris and a couple of these guys that were top producers would go on this bus and go off to a special dinner and go, someday.
It was the dinner bus.
It was a dinner. But anyway, they got to do special. But, the whole thing of seeing someone succeed and you wanting, so, I think watching Chris helped other people go, I want to be like Chris, or I want to get to that level. And I was going, gosh, I got to get on that bus one day. I couldn't even afford the friggin' hotels that they were staying at. I had to stay down the street at some kind of like Red Roof or something.
Yeah.
And then, Chris, then you start your journey outside of real estate and started growing that. And still you, that whole change from agent, leader, now CEO, how did that all happen?
It was in, Look, I never had the goal to be a president of a company or a CEO of a company. I did not want that, but I didn't have that as a goal. I had goals that were centered on achieving the results that I wanted to achieve, and every year bigger goals and bigger results. And I think I always knew deep down that if I got the results, opportunities would come as a byproduct of that. So, and part of that was too, I'm probably my own worst advocate, and I'm not great at, advocating for myself or for opportunities. Probably because again, I was shy and introverted, but I knew if I got the results, then I would get noticed or I couldn't be ignored. And so in 2008, 2004, I joined Switch Companies, joined Keller Williams. By 2008, I was one of the top agents in the company. I got a call from the CEO and who knew I was coming to Austin the next week for a meeting and said, hey, I'd like to meet with you when you're here. We've been for many years thinking about taking the company overseas. You know, we've been in North America for, you know, 20 years and we've never gone international. And there's two things, reasons why we haven't. Number one, Gary won't let us, you know, the founder won't let us until we reach a certain size. And within the next year or two, we'll reach that size. And number two, we don't have the right person to do it. And we think you could be that right person. So I met with them the next week and we agreed that that was a challenge that I was very interested in, up for it. It seemed impossible. I didn't know how to do it or how we would do it. But I liked that. I liked big challenges. And so 2 years later, we were ready to do it. I became the president of the worldwide division. And then over the next 5 years, built Keller Williams globally. And then 5 years, you know, at the end of that 5 years, there was a leadership transition. And I was the, based on the results I was getting, I was the obvious person to become the next CEO. And that was, that's what happened.
It's an amazing story, Chris. And what got me, something you said just a few minutes ago about not being the best advocate for yourself, but somebody who reaches your level of success in real estate. And as an agent myself, I know you have to be able to sell yourself at listing appointments and
an agent and a radio star for me. When I was like 4 years old, I was listening to Jimmy on the radio. No, but
I'm just surprised that you would say that because that's an important part of an agent's toolbox is to be able to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, no, I could do that. Now I could do that in a listing presentation. I had no, in fact, I could do that very effectively in a listing presentation. Every appointment I went on, I was planning on not leaving without that signature on that agreement for me to sell their home. But when it came to things like, and Bill, I think the company you're referring to, we were part of a coaching company and they would have these agents on stage.
Yep.
The top agents would be on these panel discussions and interviews. And the person that ran that, the head coach that ran that company would get agents always trying to, you know, hey, you should have me up there. I deserve to be up there. You know, here's my story, you know, blah, blah, blah. I could never and would never do that. I would never say, hey, I'd like to be up there. Or I just couldn't bring myself to do that. Which drove me, I think, even more so because I had the desire to be one of those types of agents, but it drove me just to get the results. And I remember thinking, look, I'm going to do such a good job. I'm going to achieve at such a high level that they will notice I will be asked, they will want me. And that's exactly what happened.
And there were people and you know, this, and we won't name names, got on there a little bit too early because some of the numbers were not exactly right. And I know this for a fact because, you know, when Chris talks, he's specific on what he's saying. And just now, as he said, I'm going to win that listing.
Right.
You know, I understand what you're saying because this is such an ego-driven business that, you know, you demonstrated success and were a great example for agents to say, this is how you do it. It was amazing to watch. And I wanted to ask you about the international thing. How is real estate internationally? How difficult is that? Is the United States easier or other countries easier, or is it a complete mess internationally?
It's just different. You know, depending on from what perspective you look at it, you could say it's easier or harder or messier or whatever, but it's just different for the most part in most countries. Now, two things. Number one, every country is different. Right, every culture is different.
And the rules are different.
For the most part, in most countries, the real estate industry has not evolved as ours has. There in many areas, I would say it's 20, 30, 40 years behind of where our industry is. Now there are countries where it is highly evolved, generally speaking, it's not as evolved. It's just different. It was very challenging, right? It was taking the systems and processes of a U.S. based company, and then being able to modify those to work in a different country, in a different culture, and then to find the right leaders who could facilitate that and bring that to to reality was, that was my number one job, was to find the right leaders that could do that and then help them see and create the vision to go do it.
So you're selling a master franchise. So you're doing a huge presentation for the country, and then they break it down into those various franchises. So which was harder for you, the getting the individual franchises up or the master franchises to be sold?
I had to get the master franchise right, because if I didn't do that,
there would never work.
Good foundation. So that was the challenge. It's funny we're talking about this. There, one of the master franchises that I sold, I don't know, 2012, a decade ago,
right,
was in the country of Turkey, which is still to this day one of the most successful franchises for the company.
Wow.
And the owner of that is here in town, and we're actually having dinner tonight. I had multiple groups in that country that wanted the rights, and I had to, meet with them and really, suss out who would be the right one. And fortunately, in that case, I made the right decision.
Yeah, I think I met this guy. He, highly motivated type of guy. He was totally excited. I think I met him at one of the conferences, and he just different. He was acting like an American to real estate, which is so cool. And then so your journey from that came into the CEO of the entire company, and that now that changed your role. And then how did that happen?
The current CEO had been in the role for, 15 years. He was ready, to make a change. And so the company decided that, they would transition the CEO and the president onto the board and then put in a new CEO and a new president. And again, because of, the real results that I got and their familiarity with me, and they, said, hey, we'd like you to be, the new CEO. And so that was a, there was talks about it along the way, and almost like they were preparing me and for that. So
right.
It was okay. Well, this is what's next. And then, and the dynamics with that changed, because then I was, on a daily basis, working with the founder is, a founder owned company.
Right.
And so that, that was a whole new dynamic and a whole new set of skills that I had to adapt to.
I mean, I don't know if anybody's had this, so many types of perspectives of real estate. You went from 20 years old, single agent, does that successfully, goes to this job, goes to CEO of the entire company. I mean, did you wash floors and do the bathrooms of these offices? Because you've done everything all the way up. And then now you're with Ojo. And so you really are the guy that can really articulate the changes in the industry and probably more, because you're pre-internet. So,
I think Bill, you're right. There's not too many people that, in 2009, I was the number one Keller Williams agent in the world. And in 2004, I had launched my first franchise and launched several others, and, had the number one franchises, number one brokerages in the regions that I was in for years. And so I can speak at the agent level, the brokerage level, the industry level, and understand the different dynamics at all those levels. And that's probably a little unique.
Yeah. I remember years ago, and you probably remember this, when the Blackstone Group came in and took over Century 21. And this guy was not a real estate person. He started actually MTV and all this other stuff with his group. We're doing away with the Gold Coats. And that was like, it's almost like we want to mention the beer, but it's a beer that didn't that advertised and just screwed it all up. He same thing that happened with real estate, but he didn't have that perspective that Chris has of seeing it from the ground level all the way up. And tell us a little bit about Ojo and what that is all about, because you really took a leap there and left, you know, Keller Williams CEO to this new platform, which is actually you growing dramatically.
Yeah, actually, there was a stop in between. I went after I left Keller Williams after 13 years. I had met the founder of Loan Depot, who was the second largest non-bank lender in the country, and we hit it off. And eventually, he said, "Hey, I'd really, you know, would you consider coming to work with me? And we're going to start a new company, and I want you to be the CEO of it." And I did, and we did, and. I had met the founders of Ojo prior to that, and I was an investor in their company and an advisor and then a board member. And then in 2019, Ojo was really growing. They were just about to start to become, pretty significant, and said, they came and said, "Hey, we could really use you full time. Like, would you consider it?" At the time, the mortgage industry was in one of its downturns. There wasn't, we really couldn't do some of the things that we wanted to do at Loan Depot to build this new brand and this new homeowner centric type ecosystem that we wanted to do. And I didn't see, that the industry would be getting better anytime soon. Didn't anticipate a pandemic and interest rates at 2%, right, and the mortgage industry would go through the roof. But if I had, maybe I would have stayed there. But but I joined Ojo in 2019, and early in 2020, we made a very key acquisition. We bought right in the early days of the pandemic, and we were only able to do it because it was in the early days of the pandemic, and no one was thinking about raising money or buying companies. We bought the fifth largest real estate portal in the country called Movoto.com, and when we bought that, we changed our model to a marketplace model where we meet 25 million consumers a month on our site. The ones that have needs, real estate mortgage needs, we introduce them to real estate agents and mortgage providers and help those consumers and those service providers, have a successful, successful interaction. So it's been a fun journey. Startups aren't for everyone. I always said the real estate industry is like being on a roller coaster. Yeah. Being in a startup in the real estate industry is whatever the next level of a roller coaster would be.
Right. So listen, since you're on the inside, you might know the answer to this. What does OJO stand for? What is that?
It doesn't stand for anything.
Oh,
the original company, the original name was, when they founded the company, they originally were going to use beacons to track consumer behavior and consumer traffic in restaurants and bars and retail stores.
Yeah.
And the original name of the company was going to be MapMojo. Mm. And then when they transitioned and said, "Wait a minute, we think there's a different direction we can go with." They just got rid of the map and the M and kept the OJO.
The administrator made a mistake, sent the memo out and left the M out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
interesting.
It's such a cool thing. And based on all this data, because you have data, you have stuff that you can see. So just to give us an idea of the insights of what you think, because this is the person you ask, where do you think the real estate market is going?
Absolutely.
Especially because Jimmy needs to know.
Please.
Because he's got a business he wants to run. So where do you think this is going?
So I'll answer that from an agent's perspective first. From an agent's perspective, I don't know that we need to know where the market's going. What we need to know is what the market's doing so that we can have the appropriate conversations and set the right expectations with the buyers and the sellers we're working with. You know, so we can educate them properly so that we are giving them good information that they can then make good decisions based on.
Gosh, I mean, he said a lot there in a short amount of time. That's some good stuff.
Now, you know, where the market's going, we are overdue for a correction, and affordability is an issue. What we have, though, is a situation that we've never had before, and we are in uncharted waters. We have a shortage of supply that we've had shortages of supplies before, but those were usually at stages in the cycles that were driving prices and driving appreciation. And typically, and at some point, because of affordability and other dynamics, you know, the supply will expand and demand will start to taper, and you get more balance between supply and demand. Eventually, the scale tips the other way, and you're into an adjustment period.
Do you feel like COVID had anything to do with the tightening of the market in terms of availability of units?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, right? Number one, it dramatically accelerated all sorts of things. And one of the things that accelerated was the number of transactions and number of people buying properties. And, you know, although the population continues to grow and we have a generation that's a large portion of our population that's in the buying years of their life cycle, we did use up a lot of transactions, and we probably borrowed some from the future. The other thing that the pandemic did is, because of the extremely low interest rates, we probably are experiencing for the first time, although this concept has been talked about many times over the previous decades, that this concept of rate lock, where, you know, someone has a low interest rate on their home and rates have gone up and they don't move because of it. We've never experienced this severe of a rate lock, where we had so low interest rates and such a rapid increase in rates, where people are going, you know, I got 3.25%.
Really?
And if I move, I'm going to have 6.25%.
Uh-huh.
It's not worth it.
Huge gap.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. So, you know, you've been long enough to see that we haven't seen this before ever. So, you know, Chris, I know your time is really, you know, you got a lot going on. So I wanted to say, first of all, thanks for the, I could talk to you for another several hours on this stuff. You know,
we appreciate your time.
Yeah. Man. And so, and in your book, talk about your book, where they can get your book.
Absolutely. And look, I'm happy to come back on anytime and talk more about whatever topics you think would be interesting.
Appreciate that.
The book is called Dominant Thoughts. The subtitle is Things Grow Where Our Minds Go. It's 118 pages long. It's a quick read. It's great for anyone starting off in their career, or great reminders for some of the lessons we've learned. You can go to dominantthoughts.com or just go to Amazon and search Dominant Thoughts or Chris Heller and you'll find it.
Chris, man, thank you so much. This has been great, and thanks for your time. And we want to get you back. We got to know what's going on. So, Chris, thanks again for being on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's all what it's all about, man. People's path to pro. And we'll see you next time.